Amen.
So we will have a time of communion after this, as this is the first Sunday of the month. And we're continuing our series of messages on John during this Lenten time to reflect upon Christ's last words, Christ's last teaching. And I want to begin with an observation as we talk about this there's a lot of stuff in here, right? But I'm going to focus on just one aspect of it, but I want to begin with an observation, which is that in our culture, the tendency, I believe, is that for the most part, we are defined by what we do, right? So if you go to a party, you talk to somebody that you haven't met before, one of the first questions that you will ask after you talk about the weather and whatever else, the Lakers and the Clippers, is you'll eventually get to what? What do you do, right? There's a whole bunch of things that we could ask of a person, but of all the questions, and this is, of course, not the case in every single culture throughout history, but in our culture, in our times, we ask, what do you do? People talk about their job, their education, their achievements, income, titles, marital status, how many children you may have spawned, all within the context of what I have done. And people will say also, in evaluating somebody's value to a company, in evaluating somebody's value to you, people will say something like, things like, okay, yeah, well, you know, this is what he did last year, but what have you done for me lately, right? If this is the primary way in which we understand our validation, and you happen to have something in your life that for whatever reason you understand it to fall below the societal standards for achievement and success, for having done at that point in your life, it can come a little bit uncomfortable for you, right? The more and more of these below standard things that you stack up, the more and more uncomfortable you become in social situations, because people ask and want to know, what have you done? I remember a guy a long, long time ago when we were doing a church plant in Glendale. It was a long time ago, even before we got married, Esther. We got married before that. Okay, so it was right after we got married. It was a long time ago. And right after we got married, and I remember this guy sent us an email. Back then, email was kind of like not the, you know, it was like CompuServe and AOL. You guys remember these? You couldn't even choose your name, but you know, he had this random number and hidden anonymous, and he sent an email to our church, and it asked something to the effect, or it said, stated something to the effect of, I am a high school grad, I don't have a college degree, I fix cars for a living, I'm long time ago, he said, so time's a little bit different now. I don't mean to offend people, but you know, he said, I am in my late 30s, and I'm not married. I drive a crappy car. I said, and the question was, will I be welcome in your church? And what was my response? Of course you will be, right? Well, I know, yeah, and for weeks on end, months on end, the guy never visited, I know, because I looked for a guy with that description. He's like, oh, he's going to be kind of like this, you know, loser kind of a look, you know, guy that's really disheveled, coming with a crappy car, you know, looking for that crappy car. And the guy never visited because he probably felt uncomfortable, probably felt a lot of pressure and judgment in our culture, because that's what we do. We define people. We define ourselves for the most part. We think about where we are in the world. We think about meaningfulness of our lives in terms of our achievements, what we have done, what we have not done. So we have things like bucket lists. Think about that, a bucket list. If I do these things on my bucket list, it will what? That will somehow make my life a little bit more meaningful. That's what we're really saying, right? Who I am, because who I am is determined by what I do. Who I am is determined by what I do. One of the peculiarities of Jesus, especially as recorded in the Gospel of John, is that he makes these I am statements. He makes 7 of these I am statements, and if you go to church long enough, the pastor will eventually land on a series that goes through the I am statements of Jesus in the Gospel of John. Talk about the I am, and some of these are very, very famous. Actually, all of them are very famous. I am the bread of life, Jesus says. I am the light of the world. I am the gate, he who enters through me. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. That counts as only one. And culminating with today's 7th one, which is, I am the vine. I am the true vine, he says. I am the vine. And Jesus is saying this in general, and when he makes these statements. He's saying, what I do is determined by who I am. Right? You guys catch the contrast? Who I am is determined by what I do versus what I do is determined by who I am. I do what I do because of who I am. This isn't to say what you do is not important or has no bearing on your identity. Of course it does, but he's telling us the direction and the flow of things for our sense of identity, for our sense of value. That is very different, and the resulting sense of the self winds up being very, very different. That is, if you know who you are as God has made you, you will not be shaken, no matter what the circumstances. And this is what he is explaining in today's scripture. I am the vine, and you are the branches. I am the vine, and you are the branches. How many of you guys have ever been to a vineyard? Okay. How many of you guys actually looked at grapes? When you guys, I should have asked that tree. It's like, how many guys know what grape vines and branches look like? You know, so many of you guys have been to vineyards and you're like, grapes? What are grapes? I only know when they're in their juicy form, you know, and their wine fermented. So you guys, grapevines. And this is what he's referring to. He's talking about a grapevine. And the vine of a branch, vine of a grape vine, the grapevine is the trunk, right? It's not like viney kind of a long strandly kind of stuff. And then the branches will come off of it, okay? Jesus is saying, I'm the vine. I'm the root. I'm the trunk from which you gain the life. And then he says, my father is the gardener. He is declaring our identity, the life of the disciple, Christian, not in terms of what we do, but rather in terms of our relationship, our connection to him. Jesus is saying, this is who you are. You are saved by grace alone and not by anything you do. To be a Christian, then, is to find your life source in me, to draw on me for life like a branch draws on the vine. When you do this, Jesus says, there's also an implication now for your life. Your life, what you do now changes. Something happens. Jesus says what will result inevitably is fruit. Fruit. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. He's not making you might statement. He's not saying you might possibly, some of you, or sometimes, if all things are right. He says, no, if you are a branch that is on me, that's remaining, that's connected to me, and trusting me for your life, then you will bear fruit. Fruit. So the question right now then is, what is fruit? What is fruit? We can't make it whatever we want it to be. Jesus says very specifically, talks about fruit. In the context of the Bible, the fruit always has to do with character. Okay? Transformation of who you are. Your love for justice, your love for mercy. Galatians 5, Apostle Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit. Therefore, like this, he says, the fruit of the Spirit, they are what? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. You don't have to memorize that as a list, but these are all qualities of one's character. In other words, Jesus is saying that when you trust me, when you follow me, when you call me Lord, there will be fruit. There will be transformation in your life. Okay? Now, let's pull back a little bit because Pastor Sam talked a little bit about the context in which this teaching was given. And let's put this in the context of what we've been learning. This is the last night of Christ's, the last teaching that Christ will spend giving to his disciples. And it's essentially the last time that he will see his disciples until after the resurrection. And I think Jesus is saying this to his disciples for this reason, because he wants to what? When is this dark night? Jesus is about to be crucified, taken away, given judgment by the authorities, tortured, and then hung on the cross. Jesus wants to do what? He wants to give his disciples encouragement, right? He says, look, you may see yourselves as a straggly bunch of no good, weak, feeble-hearted, worrying, and bunch, ragtag bunch of people that I have gathered, but that's not who you are anymore. He wants to remind the disciples, he says, everything that I have done and I am about to do, the loss of glory, the coming to dwell amongst you, my death and my resurrection, everything that I have done has been for you and for your fruit, for the transformation to become real in your life. I am here as the vine to give you the life that you desperately need. And I am here because I am committed to this happening in your life. To make you a person of greatness. To give you my glory. To give you my beauty. As the crown of the Father's creation that he had always intended for you to be. This is my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourselves to be my disciples. Verse 8, he says. This is what he says to his disciples. This is what he says to us. Everything that Christ has done, he has done this so that fruit is possible for us, not only possible, but that transformation becomes guaranteed. So the question that I want to ask you right now is, are you taking that seriously in your life? Are you living as if that is really true? Because every once in a while, I will run into a Christian who is convinced that people cannot change. And there's this pessimism with which they live out their faith, whether it's for others or for themselves. They say, oh, people don't change. I will never change. What's the point? Well, I will run into Christians, other set of Christians, for whom Christ's power is mainly about helping them get over a couple of hurdles, about helping them get over a couple of bad habits in their lives, while they leave mounds and mounds of stuff undisturbed. Why? Because essentially they're convinced that this mound cannot be moved, no matter what God says. And Jesus says, I am the one who created the heavens and the earth, and I am committed to your transformation. I am committed to your wholeness, your holiness, your happiness, your greatness, and your beauty. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit for the Father's glory. Do you believe that? And will you give up your small ambitions for your own character? Because doing that, folks, that would be really scary. Who knows what God might make of you? Who knows what God might do with your life, right? Now, there are two things in this teaching that Jesus gives that he says we need to understand in order to grow this fruit, this transformation, this character that develops as based on the person of Christ. The first thing, I'm going to share with you guys 2 points in the rest of this sermon. I know it's the temptation to make it 3 points. I have to practice a lot of restraint to say it's only going to be 2 points. But I want to talk about the bad branch, and I want to talk about the good branch, right? There are two sorts of branches. There's a good branch and a bad branch, right? So let me start off by asking you a question. Which branch gets cut by the gardener? The fruitful branch or the unfruitful branch? The good branch or the bad branch? Let me ask you that question. Which branch gets cut? The good branch or the bad branch? Trick question. Go back to verse 1 and 2. I am the true vine and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit. Bad branch. Then what does he do with the good branch? While every branch that bears fruit, he prunes. You guys know what pruning is. It's not like drying some, It's cutting. In fact, in the Greek, it's the exact same word. He cuts both the good branch and the bad branch. So I want to first talk about why the unfruitful branch bears no fruit, so that we can avoid the common pitfalls. And second, I want to talk about why even the fruitful branch must be cut. That's a scary thing too, right? So let's talk about the problem of the unfruitful branch, the bad branch, first. The way in which Jesus wants for us to change is by, to recap, by hooking us up into receiving a vital, organic form of life from within, from him, right? Receive a heart transplant, and then the fruit follows. If you have that, if you've been transplanted, grafted onto the vine, then the fruit is absolutely inevitable. However, this is not how most of us approach change in our lives. As much as that makes sense, as much as that clearly is the only way in which transformation will really take place, for the most part, we approach it differently. We approach it the opposite way. Most people approach change through a mechanical compliance to external forces. Not my words, somebody else's. External change helps, but only temporarily. And it doesn't have lasting change. So last week, Pastor Sam told possibly one of the funniest stories that will go down. One of the moments of cross history was given for those of you who were here and heard the message. I still can't, and I'm still kind of a little bit upset that he's out of town this week because I can't, have my, I can't make fun of him as much as I would like to because he's not here and, that just doesn't seem like fair game. But there was something else that happened at that triathlon. And for me, that was much more overwhelming. And even though I found great solace in Sam finishing, and it was really great fun for him to put in that last effort to finish under two hours, for me, it wound up being a little bit of a bad day, okay? It wound up being a bad day because, as some of you guys know, I rode the bike portion of the relay triathlon, okay? The relay was done by Nadia, Eunice, and I, and Eunice went out, and our I told them our goal was one. This is just one goal that we have for our team. One thing that's going to tell us whether or not we succeeded is to beat Young. Okay, that's all we had to do. So Eunice goes out, and she beats Young by like 25 seconds. And then during the transition time, we gain another 2 minutes, you know, because Young can, you know, he's a little bit older, and he can't stretch out as much getting out of his, getting into his bike and all that stuff. And then I do the bike portion. I felt like I was flying, okay? I do the exchange, and then Nadia goes out, and she does a swim, and she beats Young by like 2 minutes. Okay, so overall, we beat Young by like 7 minutes, and we were like, oh, yeah. And while we go home, I go home, and I look at the time splits, and I find out that even though I did just the bike portion, that Young beat me in the bike portion by 20 seconds. By 20 seconds. 40 minutes and 38 seconds versus 40 minutes and 58 seconds. And there were a bunch of people who were trying to razz me or you know, trying to make me feel worse. And I told, I think, Esther Bang at one point, I said, you know, whatever you can say to me, you cannot match how badly I feel on the inside. This is what I was doing because I was like, oh, man, I can't believe I lost. So you know what I was doing this week? I was like looking at skin suits. Skin suits, listen. Not like skin-colored suits, but like skin suits that you wear that makes you go faster, more aero. Because I read something that said wearing a skin suit will make you... And I thought, you know, I had pockets. I think that was the reason why I lost. 1% faster, it said. 1% faster. Quick math, somebody. What is 1% of 40 minutes? 24 seconds. If I had that skin suit, I would have beat Young by 4 seconds. Right? This is how we think about it's funny, it's sad. It's funny or sad that as that is. We focus on the external things all the time when we think about I mean, because essentially what really happened what would have happened if I beat Young? That I was faster with my skin suit on? No, that the skin suit is faster than Young's outfit, whatever he was wearing, right? It was a race between the clothing, not the man. But we focus on the external things and think that it will make a difference on the inside. We focus on those external things, and you know what? Those external things can help us on the short run, but it's always, almost always temporary, and it's almost, in fact, it's always not deep and meaningful. You know this, right? People say, I am going to get healthy. I'm going to get a gym membership to get healthy. Gym memberships. I read a stat. They said 4 out of 5 gym memberships never get used except for the first week of January. 4 out of 5. Can you imagine another business plan in which the people will pay me the money, but they will never use this? And I could count on it. 4 out of 5 people. 80% of people. I remember a long time ago, when we used to not have smartphones, people would buy up organizers. I remember spending time. First, it was like the paper, the Franklin method and the day planner and the day runners. Remember? It's like, oh, which one's the best organizer plan? And you would spend money, like $150 on organizers, getting different little sections. And what do? You use it like for the first week. Are you more organized? And then people went to the Palm Pilots. It was a long time ago for some of you guys. Okay. Eric, there was a time in which, like, it was a long time ago anyway. And like, are you more organized because you got smartphones? Are you really more of an organized person? Maybe it helps you with like simple things like birthdays, remembering those things so that you can post a little thing on the Facebook. By the way, last Saturday was my birthday, right? And people posted lots of things on Facebook, which is like, you know, really cool. But Somebody said, "Happy birthday, Pastor Jim." I was like, clearly somebody I met from Starbucks, right? So does that really help us in the long run? No. Let me give you a more serious example of how this gets worked out, because I received a phone call from someone I used to minister asking me for about advice for a marriage problem. And the story is rather typical because the wife, and it could be the wife, it could be the husband, right? The wife wants to leave because the guy's a jerk and abusive, and she says he's only concerned about his work. He is emotionally unavailable, and he never has time for her. And finally, she finally shares this with him, and then, you know, what happens? Almost always, the husband will say something like, "Really? Well, I knew you were upset with me about those things, but I didn't know it was that serious. If I knew that it was that serious, of course I will change." Right? They say immediately, "Of course I will change." And then usually what happens is he'll change for a little while. There's you know, the wife will say things like, "Oh, he really has changed this time around. He's really, you know, sticking to a plan. He's doing all of these things." But usually what happens is when he is pretty sure that she is back to stay, he just goes back to the way he was. He just slides right back, right? Almost always that's what happens. Or sometimes that's mechanical compliance through an external force. And sometimes he will continue to change, do the things that he promised, but what happens is he gets more and more grumpy about it. And some of you guys are remembering some of these cycles of change and unchange in your own lives. He gets more and more grumpy about it, more and more unhappy about it, more and more resentful about it, more and more frustrated with it. And then he becomes more and more demanding of her, becomes filled with more self-pity until, what, she leaves him anyway. Right? What's happening here? See, external forces, changes like that, external changes can restrain the heart but cannot change the heart. Right? What are the external forces that are at work in this situation? One is fear and the other is pride. One is fear in that this guy is thinking, "Man, you know, I won't be able to live without her. What will I do without her?" And people think, you know, "Well, that sounds like love. That sounds like really, you know, it sounds really romantic." He says, but it's not. It's really fear. He's not thinking about what he's done to her. He's not thinking about what's happening to her and her heart. That's love, to think about the other person. But he's thinking about, what will I do without her? He's thinking about all about himself. It's completely self-absorbed. Fear can get you to toe the line, right? But only for a little while. Only for a while. The other motivator that the external motivator that we use sometimes to change is pride. "I'm going to be a good husband. I'm going to be a good father. I'm not going to be like those guys who leave their wives, their kids. I'm going to love my wife. I'm going to be a great dad. I'm going to be a great guy." And I suppose that is a little bit better than changing out of fear, but in the long run, there is no real change, because when you change out of both fear and pride, the problem is, the reason you have an issue in the first place is because of fear and your pride. So if you use fear and pride to try to change, you haven't touched the heart at all. Right? You've actually fed your fear and your pride. The problem with the unfruitful branch isn't that it doesn't want to bear good fruit, but that it fails to touch the real source of the problem. Right? Folks, this happens to Christians in the church all the time, right? Someone will start coming out to church, become a Christian, and without knowing better, they will sometimes be encouraged to just do, do, and do. And there's this equation of busyness in the church and just coming out to church and doing stuff in the church, serving, worshiping. All these are good things, but there's this push toward doing stuff and keeping yourself busy in the churchy spiritual things. Go to as many Christian concerts as possible. Listen to as much Christian music and read as much Christian books. To do that, we think, is spiritual life. But what is often really happening is that your focus is on busyness rather than on having a relationship, a true friendship, a guiding friendship with Jesus. Spiritual life, for many of us, equals busyness in the church. We do this because even though we say we are saved by grace alone and not by our works, the human heart has an incredibly hard time really believing that. Because even though we've been taught to say you are saved by grace alone and nothing else, for many of us, immediately, as soon as we say that, make that statement, there's something off, something else that goes, really? That just seems too good to be true. When we think we have to do more and more things. So after years of being a Christian like this, in this way, what happens to these people when these external spiritualized busyness goes away and you find yourself having time to just be? What happens? People become joyless. People become anxious. So that after all these years of being a Christian like this, you're not really much more loving. You're not much more joyful. You're not much more patient. You're not much more humble. You're not better at taking criticism. You have that sensitivity to anything that people might possibly say against you. And you're no better at overcoming your habits. You've hardly changed at all, right? You changed only a little bit. Very little fruit. Why? Because you aren't drawing from the life-giving vine. The way in which transformation works, Jesus explained, is not with us bargaining with him or trying to do things so that we can get on his good side, wondering if we haven't given enough or wondering if we haven't tried hard enough. If you're thinking like that, you've made Christianity, in C.S. Lewis's words, both too hard and too easy. He puts it like this in Mere Christianity, probably one of the best introductions to Christianity. C.S. Lewis says, the Christian way is different, harder and easier. Christ says, I don't want so much of your time and so much of your money and so much of your work. Christ says, I want you. I have not come to torment your natural self. He says, but to kill it. No halfway measures are any good. I don't want to cut off a branch here and a branch there. I want to have the whole tree down. I don't want to drill the tooth or crown it or stop it, but to have it out. Hand over the natural self, all the desires which you think innocent as well as you think wicked, the whole outfit. I will give you a new self instead. In fact, I will give you myself. My own will shall become yours. Jesus says, I want your life. I want the reason why you get up in the morning, every morning, to be me. The branch has no life apart from me. Jesus doesn't want just grades and just qualified. Well, he is number one, but there's a pretty close number two in my life. Jesus wants to be in a category of his own. He wants everything. A little son, Max, you guys all, this is no news for me to share with you guys. He really loves his mommy a lot more than his daddy, okay? It's true. I'm not hurt. He loves me, but he asked me this question. He asked me this question last week. He said, "Is it okay if I love mommy just a little bit more?" I'm like, "Yes." But that's not what God wants from us. Just a little bit more. God doesn't want for us to love him just a little bit more. God doesn't want for us to love him a lot more. God doesn't want for us to love him so much more. God wants to be in a completely different category. The whole vine, your life. And then let everything else, your priorities, then let it fall after that. That's what God wants. That's the problem of the bad branch. The second branch, the fruitful branch. There's a second type of cutting that the gardener does. It's at verse 2. He cuts off every branch that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so that it will be even more fruitful. Right? And the promise is this, which is, you won't grow without pruning. You won't grow without something getting cut in your life. You won't grow without God taking his scissor, his knife to your life. Have you guys ever watched a gardener prune a tree, prune grapes, a grapevine, whatever? Almost always, in fact, always, whenever I watch these professionals prune, what do you think? It looks like a disaster, right? It looks like something that if you saw your kids do, then they would get in major trouble for. Right? The gardener, you just go, "Oh, that's too much. That's way too much." He just cut off, "Oh, that's a tree." He's, you know, it looks like he's attacking the poor plant, right? And you look underground, right? And you look around and go, "Look at that. That was like my favorite branch." You see these beautiful leaves, that perfectly healthy, strong-looking leaves, and possibly a fruit as well. If you look at the branches themselves also, they look like they're hurt, and they're looking to you for rescue, right? It looks like it will never survive, it will never be the same again. And it's, "Oh, you just messed it up." But a skilled gardener, and this is a phrase that I thought was wonderful when I read it, it says, "There is not a thing that is cut off for the skilled gardener that would not have been a loss to keep and a gain to lose." Let me read that again. "There's not a thing that is cut off that would not have been a loss to keep and a gain to lose." In other words, everything that came off had to come off if that plant was going to reach its fullness, productivity, and power. You go to every vineyard website, and some of you guys have been to a lot more vineyard websites than I have, if you guys know what I mean. Now, and actually go into some of the details of what they do, and they'll talk at length about the pruning process. I was really surprised by all this information that there was. But the way in which people get at these vineyards the kind of grapes that they want that will produce the most wonderful wine is by careful but massive pruning. We sometimes look at our lives. We'll say all these things. We'll look upon our lives and we'll say all these awful things that have happened to us. And we'll say, we'll look and we'll say, there's no reason why that should have happened. There's no reason why that should have happened, right? People will say, I should have gotten that job. There's no reason why I should not have been, should have been passed over. I should have gotten that job. Or people say in terms of relationships, I should have gotten that relationship. That relationship should have never gone that way. There was no reason why that should have happened in that relationship. And Jesus is saying, that's because you don't understand gardening. Bearing good fruit requires pruning and seeming loss and trusting that God will only prune those things that would have been a loss to keep and a gain to lose. Do you understand that in your life? Some of you guys, last week met my oldest sister, Caitlin, who visited with her daughter, my niece, my new niece, newest niece. And technically, since this message goes out on the internet, I cannot mention her name for legal reasons. Not yet. But for my sister and my brother-in-law, they experienced childlessness for over 20 years. 20 years of marriage. Incredibly painful times. Incredibly painful times in which there were branches that were pruned. A time in which they could not experience the joy of parenthood that they both longed for. And there was no good reason why that should have happened. There's no good reason why that should have happened. They're both incredibly good, kind, and faithful people. They would have been great, great parents 20 years ago. You could have said, man, what sort of a God would do that? Now listen, look, I'm incredibly conscious of and skeptical of making everything make sense and making everything turn out to have a great story. You guys know that about me, right? But when I saw them this past month, as I met my newly adopted niece for the first time, and who was born into an incredibly dire situation, who so desperately needed for my sister and my brother-in-law to love her, to fight for her, and to rescue her, essentially, I knew that those 20 years of childlessness was not a time of barrenness, but was a pruning process so that this incredible fruit might take place. The shaping of all three of their lives for a time of fruit that no one could have possibly imagined. It's so funny because, just as an aside, this is one of those things I shared with you guys a little bit before. When Pastor Sam says, I'm not an emotional person like that, and you just go, really? You're not an emotional person? And I tell you, this is one of these things where I cried last night just trying to put together these words, and it was really hard for me to just put together, find the words to put together this. But I cannot cry now because that's how I am wired. I am not an emotional person. Jesus is making it clear here, folks. There is no growth. There is no fruit without pruning. There is no growth. There is no fruit. There's no transformation without you feeling pain first. Oh, how nice it would be in one sense if the bad branch was the only one that got the knife. But Jesus says, you know, That's only if the gardener didn't really care. That's only if the gardener really didn't care what sort of fruit came out of your life. But he cares about your fruit. And he cares about you, about it so much. He's committed to it so much. That this Easter time is a time in which we're reflecting upon how much he cared that he gave up his only begotten son, so that this son who reigned with him throughout all eternity, before, present, and after, came, was given up to suffer the most tremendous loss possible. There is no growth without understanding that the Lord who gives us the Son is committed to our lives, our transformation, so much that he's willing to prune, that he's willing to let us experience pain, so that you might receive incredible joy. Maybe God is at work in your life right now. Maybe there's something in your life that you know for sure that's painful and feels like a pruning. Maybe you're going through a tough time right now and you may need to pray and ask if you're being pruned by the gardener who knows you and loves you far more and better than you can possibly imagine. Maybe this is a time which you say, Lord, let me trust you even more through this time. If you're connected to me, you'll be cut back into fruitfulness. But if you're not, you will be cut off. If you're connected to me, the painful things that come into your life, you will understand what that was for. Let's spend a little time in just committing ourselves to this vision of fruit that God has imagined for us in our lives. This band leads us in worship, and after that, we're going to take communion together.